Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. The last time we looked at Disney was in our 1978 episode about British animation. A quick recap. After the deaths of Walt and Roy Disney in 66 and 71, respectively, for a little while, management just continued along with the playbook left behind by the Disneys, but then realized pretty quickly that wasn't going to work, and they needed to make some changes. In 78, Walt's son-in-law, Ron Miller, a former LA Rams football player and aspiring actor and producer, took over the creative reins, while the more conservative E. Carden Walker was calling the financial shots. Disney was making some pretty, in hindsight, rough decisions, like turning down Star Wars. And even though 70s animations like Robin Hood and The Rescuers had done pretty well, and Disney was still a frontrunner in animation, they moved to release more edgy live-action fare that would appeal to teenagers and less family-friendly animations. The Black Hole, their answer to Star Wars and Disney's first PG movie, tanked hard. And although Ron was instrumental in diversifying the Disney brand, he started Touchstone, he was incredibly unpopular. Walker came under fire for failing to realize the game was changing. Tron flopped hard, in part because he refused to spend money on marketing it against other movies like E.T., which spent $10 million on marketing alone. Disney was on the verge of bankruptcy. It was time for some new blood. Enter Paramount's Michael Eisner and his team. Alicia, do you want to walk us through the early Eisner-Walls years and a little bit of Jeffrey Katzenberg while we're at it?
Sure, yeah. So 1984 is kind of the key year. So just 2 years before we're going to hit the films that we're talking about today on the podcast. That's where you get Michael Eisner, who is a Paramount executive, being hired to front Disney's feature animation and feature film department. They also bring on Jeffrey Katzenberg, also from Paramount, to kind of balance this duo, if I may. And then the third person who's very important is Frank Wells, who is an executive from Warner Brothers. So this is really the trifecta that is important to know about for why Disney both plummets at a certain point in the 1980s and then has this incredible renaissance. I think the Disney renaissance is definitely a term that we hear a lot, and myself included, I think we get very confused about when does the Disney Renaissance actually begin, and that's what's going to be interesting for this episode. It definitely begins around the time of like 1986, even though I think Little Mermaid, which is 1989, is sort of the like cornerstone of the Disney Renaissance. But what ends up happening is, you know, feature filmmaking is going really poorly at Disney. Fox and the Hound was a huge disaster. Fox and the Hound is 1981, and this is the moment where someone whose name you're going to hear a lot on this episode, Don Bluth, decides that, you know, Disney's basically corrupt, quits, forms his own animation house, and poaches the Disney animators. So Fox and the Hound ends up taking way longer than it should because there were no animators to actually finish the film. And this is why something like in 1984, it's so important to bring in new blood. Up until this point, Roy E. Disney, who is Walt Disney's nephew, the son of Roy O. Disney, who was also instrumental in the studio era of Disney's history, he kind of becomes more of a figurehead and is in many ways cast off. He's allowed to be on the board, which will eventually change. There's a lot of tension at this point between these very important four people, Frank Wells, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Michael Eisner, and Roy E. Disney. And Frank Wells is the kind of glue that holds them all together. He will eventually die in a very tragic helicopter accident in 1994. And then all hell breaks loose. But luckily, we're talking about 1986, so things are a little bit more positive at this point. And what's really controversial at this point is that Eisner and Katzenberg decide that there should be a television unit for animation at Disney. And this was something that Walt Disney, the man, was wholly against. Like, obviously, this is Disney. Their animations are meant to be seen theatrically. They're feature films. Up until this point, they were also against home video markets. The Disney Vault will come out pretty soon, but they were never going to release Pinocchio and never release Bambi and Snow White on VHS. They changed their tune quite quickly. And so because the television unit is formed, they evict the feature film animators from the very historic Walt Disney Animation Building and put them in a hangar and like warehouses and like portables. So really what you're seeing here is feature film animation is becoming ghettoized, if I should say that.
But yeah, there's no better way to say
yeah.
it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and this is at a time when Tim Burton is working for Disney. This is around The Black Cauldron, which is going to be released in 1985 and is a complete disaster. If you think Tron was a disaster, and it certainly was because of the budget, you know, The Black Cauldron almost ends Disney animation as we know it in a feature film market. But what's interesting about that is as they realize that The Black Cauldron is going very poorly, there is this new lane that appears for a film called The Great Mouse Detective, where they take Ron Clements, who is working on The Black Cauldron, and John Musker, then are given permission to make The Great Mouse Detective in conjunction with The Black Cauldron and do it cheaply and in a more classic Disney vein, more in a vein that would be familiar to you know, the old Nine Men, the classic era of Disney, if we say, is from the 30s to 60s. And whereas The Black Cauldron is dismal, box office failure, critical failure, demoralizing, I would say, to most of the animators, The Great Mouse Detective does really well. And so it's an important film for understanding the beginning of the Disney Renaissance. Oliver and Company's in the middle of Little Mermaid in 1989 and Great Mouse Detective in 1986. But if you didn't have The Great Mouse Detective, which was critically lauded and also hugely financially successful, I believe it was only made for like $16 million. I could be wrong. Maybe $25 million? I can't remember the number.
It's low. I think it's 16 or so. Yeah.
Yeah, 16. Yeah. Super low. And what they achieved was a look that was very reminiscent of why people fell in love with Disney in the first place.
And I think you're right that Oliver and Company is the reason why it is not counted as part of the Disney Renaissance, because there's a movie in between it and Little Mermaid.
Yeah, and Oliver doesn't do super well, which they're kind of... Oh, no, maybe it did do really well.
It does, yeah. It beats Fievel, even.
Yes, that's right.
But it's just not... It's not animated the same. It's got the soundtrack by Billy Joel, so it's it's a little too much of a cool
new... I think what it did for the Renaissance, though, is make them realize that you could get huge stars as voice actors, because you also have Cheech Marin, and we're going to talk about, you know, really big names in the two films. We're going to talk about, like, Madeline Kahn and fucking Vincent Price.
Yeah.
Vincent Price is a Disney villain. Thank God this happened. Yeah, the Disney Renaissance to me is always very perplexing, and I think a little bit more scrutiny needs to be paid to it, and I think probably more importance on The Great Mouse Detective needs to be instilled.
I think anyone who's watching this kind of era, because these are still technically considered dark era films, and the actual Renaissance is considered to be The Little Mermaid, because that's the one that also got them critical accolades as well as financial accolades.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's also really important that they realized, and they kind of figured out with Great Mouse Detective, and then it blooms a bit in having Billy Joel do the music, and then you get Alan Menken and them doing the music then. Mm-hmm. They figured out the music is what sells the movie, and that's such a big part of it. You do have, we'll get into The Great Mouse Detective in a second, but there's a couple really interesting songs in that one that I think are some of the more memorable moments. And then there's a ton of Billy Joel, because it's Billy Joel. And then, I mean, everyone was singing Part of Your World for how long? So I think the music is such a key part of them figuring out what it is. And although Fievel has one banger, the music isn't as clear. And we'll get into that later.
Which makes it interesting that The Great Mouse Detective is much less musical. In fact, it's really in the vein of something like 101 Dalmatians, which has songs, nothing that is super memorable other than for how lavacious and wrong the songs are. But it's truly not a musical. So it almost comes back to something like Bambi. It's a rare film in Disney's canon of feature animation to not have a musically based song. a musically based film.
All right. Well, let's get into The Great Mouse Detectives. One of the things that I love about it is that Michael Eisner was worried about it being too British after young Sherlock Holmes tanked hard. And he was like, how do we make it less British? It was originally called Basil of Baker Street, which is a series of books it was based on. Mm-hmm. And he's like, we're going to call it The Great Mouse Detective. And we'll get into the inter-office memo that critiqued this pretty hard at the time.
Which, keep in mind, there is no point in this film where the lead character is referred to as the Great Mouse Detective. He's that always Basil of Baker Street, which is the Eve Titus books that she's a really interesting children's author. Yeah, it's so strange. I mean, I actually do understand what Eisner, that's what's interesting about Eisner. He's a smart businessman. And yeah. I know he's hated, and we'll get into him a little bit more. I know Cam has some thoughts on him. Like, he's really vilified. Like, he is Radican, basically. But actually a very smart decision if you think about it.
Cam, before we go any further, why don't you give us a quick little plot summary on this one?
Sure. Well, part of the reason I also think that this movie took forever to make, because they were thinking about it for a while because the Eve Titus books were big, but it was a lot like The Rescuers, obviously. It is about a mouse detective, much like the mice detectives of The Rescuers. So they shelved it for a little while. Also worth saying that while this is loosely based on the Eve Titus books, they throw out 99% of the books.
Yeah,
it's basically just the character names. Weirdly, it's the story of a little girl whose father is kidnapped. She doesn't really know what to do. She runs into David Q. Dawson, who is the Watson of this. He has pretty much exactly Watson's backstory. He was involved in some mouse war in Afghanistan. And
I want to get into these mouse politics as well. I am concerned about what sort of mouse diplomacy caused this.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, both of these films feature, they imply mouse atrocities that we don't want to know about. He knows that there is a great detective, Basil of Baker Street. So he takes Olivia Flavisham is her name. He takes her along to Basil. From here on, it's basically a traditional Sherlock Holmes. Basil is Sherlock. Dawson is Watson. And the interesting thing to me is I think that they are, it is so obviously that. Radigan, as we mentioned, is Moriarty. Mm-hmm. It's so that they're able to essentially, I think, write off the Sherlock Holmes plot, being like, you know, like Sherlock Holmes. So then they are able to do like a double plot, which is also on top of Sherlock Holmes as a mouse, because you just take that for granted. It's all cliches. They're like, what if Sherlock Holmes teamed up with a child, which is a lot of fun, too. So, yeah, they're trying to figure out why her father, who's a toy maker, was kidnapped. You end up learning that Radigan has this elaborate plan to replace Queen Victoria with an automaton.
Mouse Queen Victoria.
Yes,
or
mouse
is it the
Queen
real
Victoria.
Queen Victoria?
No, Mouse Queen Victoria.
Yeah.
We're in the mouse world. It's all mouse. But yeah, so he wants to essentially become the King of England by replacing Queen Victoria with an automaton who says whatever he wants.
And it's the Queen's Diamond Jubilee,
yes.
Right? It's 1897.
But it's also the Diamond Jubilee of the real Queen Victoria.
Yes.
These mouse parallels
who
are very
see.
Concerning
yeah.
to me.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. It's important to point out that you do see, like The Rescuers, you see the human characters. So, like, Basil the mouse lives below the real Sherlock Holmes, and they're using, I think they're using Basil Rathbone's some audio, not from the Sherlock films, but something he did for radio. They're actually, you get a little bit of that voice in the upstairs part of this Baker Street apartment, so you do see the real Queen, Queen Victoria. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. So anyway, they, you know, there's elaborate fun. They all get in a fight. Basil succeeds. Radigan is stopped. Olivia finds her father again.
And Olivia also says the word Toby so often. I love
there's
the dog.
They ride around on a basset hound.
There's a lot of homages in this in terms of its animated characters to classic Disney animated characters. Like, to me, the dog Toby is straight out of Aristocats and Fox and the Hound to some extent. And then also you really see there's a reference to Bill the lizard in the bar scene, which we're going to talk about the surly dockside bar, which I can't decide if it's laziness or if it's like a tribute. I'm unclear, but I think they're recycling a lot of characters.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, it's also like we said that it was made for cheap. It's not only made for cheap, it's their budget is slashed in the middle of it, and their timing is moved up 6 months, I think, at least. So they are working faster for less money as well.
Yeah, this is a summer film, whereas when we're going to talk about An American Tale, that is a holiday, like Thanksgiving, Christmas film. And I'm wondering if they moved up the Great Mouse Detective's schedule because of knowing An American Tale was coming out during the holidays, because originally they were going to be at the same time on the same weekend, which
yeah,
is
might be
baffling.
Well, one of the reasons this was as inexpensive to make as it was is, although they did have the classic animators doing their animation thing, this is also one of the first movies. It's not the first, but it's one of the first animated films to start including CGI, which would take a lot of like the extra grunt work out of the animation that takes a long time. So they were able to smooth out images, make things continuous. And that is most evident in this giant clock fight scene at the end, which is real cool looking. And the reason it's so cool looking is it is inspired by a Japanese anime film, which is one of Miyazaki's first films, called Lupin III: Castle of Cagliostro. If you haven't seen it, go see it. It's so much fun. It's a heist movie and a chase.
It's like from 1979.
Really early. It's one of the most inspirational, not just in animation, but like in action movies. Watching this movie, you're like, this is a massive touchstone film. And the battle in the clock tower is not quite, but it's real freaking close of how these two battles are.
I rewatched it relatively recently, and I think Great Mouse Detective deserves more credit, but I actually think that their clock fight is better.
Whoa!
Sorry, Miyazaki. But it's worth saying as well that 1986 is also the first year of Studio Ghibli with Castle in the Sky.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be out in America yet, but that Lupin the Third did help him start his own little animation wing.
Is Nausicaä Valley of the Wind not Ghibli? There's something complicated
with that
one, right?
It might not be Ghibli. Yeah. It might be made for hire.
Because that's 84. But I think you're right. Castle in the Sky is the first
adaptation
sort
of a manga.
Right.
I think you guys are right that this might be one of the least Disney movies. I mean, they are recycling stuff and they're using CGI and there's a different look to it. But Cam, you had a great point that a lot of the animation feels very Tex Avery inspired as opposed to being classic Disney.
Radigan, well, just, especially.
Yeah, and Radigan. Fidget. And yeah, totally. Yeah, Fidget as well. I just think the way that they pull faces, it's the kind of elastic reality of Warner Brothers, which you see now. It's actually kind of went away a lot in the Renaissance, but now you see in something like Hotel Transylvania is kind of coming back. Those guys who love that old animation. It's just for some reason, Disney got very into like your character's design, like I think strict character design, honestly. You don't deviate from the physics and reality. But yeah, we talk about Radigan, and it was designed by Glenn Keane, who is kind of, he's considered a key part of the Renaissance. He's a supervising animator for a lot of these movies, and he's also a character designer. He designs Ariel, he designs the Beast, he designs Aladdin, but he designed Radigan here. The fun fact about him is he's the son of Bill Keane, the creator of Family Circus. But he started with Bianca and Bernard of The Rescuers.
Which I have to say, I love The Rescuers so much. Oh, yeah. It gets a lot of flack. I don't understand why.
Honestly say, we're talking all most movies today. My most movie was The Rescuers, partially because they re-released it before Rescuers Down Under. So that was probably the first one I saw in theaters. This is a little early for me, Mouse Detective and Fievel. But also, I will say that if you want to hear somebody shit on The Rescuers, listen to Don Bluth. Don Bluth has some problems with especially the visual design. Anyway, Glenn Keane is kind of one of the cool animators who started towards when everyone was leaving and kind of took over. And I think to this day, everybody always, when Glenn Keane appears, they're like, oh, this is going to be fancy.
I mean, coming back to Radigan, like, what a fantastic villain. And I'm not a huge fan of The Great Mouse Detective. It's interesting because, like, the three of us collectively are the age where, you know, the VHS era of Disney was really our childhood. Yeah. And something like The Great Mouse Detective was a big release. But I didn't love it as a kid, and I don't love it now, unfortunately. Although I have respect for it after learning this historical context. But I love Radigan. I love Radigan, voiced by Vincent Price. I love all the references within Radigan's character to canonical Vincent Price, like Corman films. Like, at one point, Radigan eats a mouse named Bartholomew, who's a drunk at the bar. Really dark. It's like the first 5 minutes of the film. And Bartholomew is a character that's killed off by Vincent Price's character in Pit and the Pendulum from the 60s.
Oh, yes.
And there's just a lot of cute references. Yeah, he feeds him to his cat.
To kill him.
Yeah, speaking of cats, I just want to outline that I watched both of these films with my cat beside me, and you could cut the tension in the room with a knife. These are, I'm always so sad that cats are treated so poorly by Disney. Maybe Aristocats was a big failure. Like, I guess this is, we're getting a lot of mean cats in those two films.
You understand they're just waiting to kill you and eat your face, right? They're just like, just die, and that those beautiful cheeks will be mine.
Also, we're saying, someone did point out that everyone making fun of the title, The Great Mouse Detective, is ignoring the title Aristocats.
Which yeah, is real maybe, rough.
It's a pun, but it's pretty straightforward. It's describing what they are.
Yeah.
But I mean, talking about the tension in Disney, like people, the animators were so pissed off and were so tired of these people who they didn't think knew anything about what the actual art they were doing was and were coming in and telling them what to do. So the renaming inspired animator Ed Gombert to write a satirical inter-office memo, is what they called it, about Peter Schneider, who was the executive at the time, who it sounds like he eventually earned their respect, but there is a lot going on there. And it retitled all the preceding Disney films things like Seven Little Men Help a Girl, The Wonderful Elephant Who Could Really Fly, The Little Deer Who Grew Up, The Girl with the See-Through Shoes, Two Dogs Fall in Love, Puppies Taken Away, and my personal favorite, A Boy, A Bear, and a Big Black Cat. And then
which one's that?
Jungle Book.
Oh, of course.
It's fine. It was a category of Jeopardy. You're not alone.
Yeah.
I feel like inter-office memos are a weird like tradition at Disney too, mm-hmm. because you see all the like whenever they're picketing, there's like weird inter-office memos, and sometimes there's like dirty stuff written on like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs letterhead, and of course there's a terrible one about women at some point that leaked how rude he was about not hiring women.
Yeah, no surprise there.
I mean, I know Ratigan, in terms of his look, is based on former Disney CEO Ron Miller.
Yeah.
Who is Walt Disney's son-in-law, long after Walt Disney passed, was a LA Rams football player.
That's
He's like
right.
6'6", broad shoulders, so they just like put a little bit of Vincent Price and a little bit of this man that they all absolutely hated into the.
And
Glenn Keane was just literally working on storyboards, and he came in to look at them, and Glenn Keane was like, whoa. And apparently his guy was such a huge linebacker that looked so much like him, they're like, tone it down, Glenn. It's like, all right.
A little too close. Well, I think the part that most people remember from their childhood that seems like a fever dream is that weird pirate sailor bar. And I'm always curious as to why these like sailor bars book the most vulnerable performers. Like if you're juggling or holding someone on your shoulders, you cannot fend off flying knives or vegetables. And I had this friend who told me these stories about doing stage magician circuits in northern Alberta, and I assume this is a very similar experience. But yeah, I've always wondered, like, why are you seeing these poor acts where they can't use their hands? It's quite the scene.
This is definitely my favorite sequence of The Great Mouse Detective. I know the Big Ben, you know, climax gets discussed a lot, but when Basil and Dawson dress up as lowly dockside workers and try to, as a cover, you know, go to the bar, it's really fun. And there's like, so I think the risqueness that we're going to talk about is the
Let Me Be Good to You.
So there's this like, it's not a striptease necessarily, but it's very burlesque in that you're seeing this very voluptuous female mouse who's wearing like garters and a very like kind of, let's say, Moulin Rouge-esque costume. I'm trying not to be too risque here, but in how I describe her, sing this like song, and it's quite controversial for a Disney film even up to this point, and I think caused a lot of consternation with like they wanted to censor it.
There is an official statement from the animators which reads, "The segment was a cabaret song and harmless in lyrics, and because the character animated singing it was a mouse, not a human, and it is thus not questionable." And I'm like, the lyric is, "Hey fellas, I'll take away all your blues. Hey fellas, there ain't nothing I wouldn't do just for you." And I'm like, sorry,
Smokey.
Sorry, go ahead, Cam.
Well, the one thing I was going to say is they famously animated it before they had the song. So that's one thing. So they were just going, because apparently that had to be reworked quite a bit, because they late in the game chose Melissa Manchester to do this song, which I think was written by Henry Mancini still.
And it was going to be Madonna or Liza Minnelli.
What? Yes.
Back to Cabaret.
But Melissa Manchester had this crazy thing where she was the first ever person to be nominated twice for Best Original Song at the Oscars, because she had one for Ice Castles and one for The Promise in 1985. So obviously she was this very hot of the moment person that they took and then tried to shoehorn in, which you'll also hear with Don Bluth and An American Tale, is a mess to try to do a song last minute. So I think that maybe the song is sexier than they expected, and maybe they were doing the dance a little sexy and did not expect the song to be sexy, and they came together to be very, very
it was
sexy.
So sexy that this film was not allowed to be shown to children in Scandinavia. So it's like, it was rated for children over the age of 12, which I'm just like, it's Scandinavia. Like, if yeah. you're too dark as a children's film for Scandinavia...
You got some stuff going on.
You know, a land of darkness.
And I mean, my personal favorite part of this, and it was our small person's favorite part of this as well, was the Rube Goldberg machine death trap. That bit's pretty great. I'm like, oh, that's actually really fun. And the getting Vincent Price to sing a song, which you know he contractually obligated. Sure. He's like, I will do this, but I will sing.
Apparently it was unusual for him to sing a song, and he was delighted.
Yeah.
He said his lifelong dream since he was like had first watched Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was to become a Disney villain, and so he realized it quite late in life, much to I think all of our delight.
It's good. I also want to shout out briefly, just in my research, I watched a long video by this YouTuber Cheekbone, and it gets a little intense on its dissection of The Great Mouse Detective. But the one thing she does point out, which is she's backed up by this song, is the fact that this might be the only Disney movie where you have a queer-coded villain and a queer-coded hero who seem to only be in love with each other. And she's like, the fact that there's a sexy lady mouse dancing around and Basil doesn't care at all just proves that he only loves Radigan.
Apparently
there is quite a intense fandom of Basil Radigan, you know, tying each other up, etc.
Oh, boy.
Like there's online fan fiction and like drawings.
Oh,
and
yes.
Stuff?
Yeah,
oh, yes.
My
God. Furries. I mean,
it's a huge, considering it's an old movie pre-internet, there is a significant fandom of Basil and Radigan.
Oh, my gosh.
Being
well,
in love with each other.
There is a live action version of this planned where the mice are going to be animated, but the rest of the world is going to be real. Not quite cats. I'm sorry, Alicia. Maybe someday. But it sounds like that will give plenty of people some fan fiction food for thought.
Yeah, I mean, that's they're keeping it alive, the furries. Good for them. The one thing I just wanted to talk about that I think is kind of interesting, just from a technical standpoint, is when we were talking about that, when you talk about the clock tower sequence, there was a kind of a very fascinating thing, because the animators ran into this problem where they couldn't find reference pictures for any of this, especially the inside of Big Ben was a huge problem. And I think that this is interesting where you see the support of Katzenberg and Eisner a bit, because the clock tower sequence was actually pretty far into production. Somebody suggested that they were like, hey, what about this? What if they fight inside the clock tower?
Well, because they'd done clock tower stuff with Peter Pan, obviously, so a lot of reference to Big Ben in an animation. But yeah, it's
Mary
cool
Poppins has a clock tower too, doesn't it?
Yeah. She hangs off there.
But anyway, so it was very fascinating, because they realized a little late that they didn't really have these references, and they actually sent somebody to England. He kept harassing the Home Office constantly until they were like, fine, get on a plane. The fascinating thing is, number one, he had to take reference photos completely lying down, because he was trying to do it from the point of view of a mouse, which was part of the problem. But he got to do this at Big Ben, Buckingham Palace. He like got to do it around England in these fascinating places. But my favorite story is Big Ben. Apparently, it's so intense when the bells ring, you really don't want to be inside of it. So he had 10 minutes to run in and take a bunch of photos around the gears. And he still wore earmuffs just in case the bells went off. It was it sounds pretty crazy, but it's like a super beautiful idea. And the fact that they put that much care even into this movie that was rushed and budget slashed, I think still shows a certain level of...
At the end of the day, I think really recognizing that at this point, people were fighting for animation to be recognized as an art. Like in the term of, in terms of the film world, which we're going to discuss later on, I'm sure, animation and especially feature animation was very much the red-headed stepchild of the film world, which really didn't change until Little Mermaid, Aladdin, and that's when people started to see it as pieces of the art that it actually is.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that there's also, you'll see, what we're about to talk about, Don Bluth, is somebody who is very artistically focused. But I also think that the interesting thing is when you're talking about Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg, like for better or worse, was very early on one of the people who understood. He has this quote from 1986 where he says, like, the value of animation is beyond a box office. Like, mm-hmm. essentially, that when you create a new character, there's intellectual property and merchandise and theme parks. And it's worth saying Roy E. Disney paid out of pocket to create theme park characters. Mm-hmm. He paid for those costumes to be made for The Great Mouse Detective because he believed in it enough. And like you say, he was not that involved anymore. So this is just like a board member saying, cutting a check to a costume designer at the park saying, I believe in this project enough. And yeah, I think that it's the weird thing where, like, again, these guys are just businessmen, but at the same time, Eisner was like, oh, let's just shut down Great Mouse Detective. And Katzenberg was like, you're employing 175 people to make a movie. We can either pay them to not make a movie or pay them to make a movie. You might as well make the movie. I don't know.
There's a really good interview with Diane Sawyer around this time with Michael Eisner and then also with Roy E. Disney separately. And she kind of questions, like, why, if all these films have lost so much money, why are you still making animated films? Like, aren't they, you know, old-fashioned? Aren't they outdated? This is not what kids want. And, like, Michael Eisner gives a bullshit answer that's very businessman-like. But Roy E. Disney, like, he almost, you see the tears in his eyes where he's just like, because that's what my uncle established and that is what the Disney brand is. And yes, these don't make money. And yes, we make money off theme parks and we're building Euro Disney and we're doing all these things. But, like, the cornerstone is the animated films. That's what, exactly what you're saying, Cam, creates the toys and the home video and the theme park rides and the, you know, everything else, the PJs, the
and the lifelong devotion, right? That's what you get, that you hook them early, hook them young. That's what the kids like.
And it's worth saying, in 1985, the reason they survived the Black Cauldron disaster is they had a re-release of 101 Dalmatians that made them like hundreds of millions of dollars. So. There was they knew something was there, even the craven monsters can sometimes start a. It's not like these guys weren't around for the Disney Renaissance. They were approving The Little Mermaid as this movie was being made, so, you know.
They just figured out how to fix it. I can't wait to talk about The Little Mermaid. That's coming up. But our next movie is also going to be about mice living in a secret world unseen by humans. Although this one has Cossacks and pogroms and a speech-impedimented, socially conscious socialite. It's complex fun for the whole family. And we're going to look at An American Tale after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Although Disney Animation was making a comeback, there was one animator who was determined to keep the art of hand-drawn 2D animation alive and challenge kids with difficult concepts. Don Bluth started working at Disney in the late 60s and early 70s. He was hired right out of high school on a basis of his strong portfolio to work on movies like Robin Hood and The Rescuers, which is going to be important for our story today. Bluth left Disney to attend university, and when he returned, it was a company in cost-cutting turmoil, as we discussed earlier. According to Bluth, he was working as the head animator on movies like Pete's Dragon, and he continually butted heads with the higher-ups when he wanted to return to classic animation techniques that were time-consuming and therefore costly, but ultimately created a stronger product. This eventually led to his leaving the company. Now, that's his side of the story. The other side is that Bluth played favorites with the animators who were willing to work in his garage on short films in their spare time, which people got testy about, and it caused divisions in the company. However it went down, Bluth and two others from the Disney company jumped ship to form Don Bluth Productions and make The Secret of Nim. Not only does that movie hold up, it is a frickin' masterpiece.
You love that film.
I love it. That so is like, much. Yeah. I love it. I love it. I love Jeremy. I love the Sparklies. I love the. I love Timothy. I love the kids.
I've never seen it.
It's wonderful. It is a Dom DeLuise performance for the ages. You're gonna love it so much. It's so good.
Oh, I love. I mean, you know, isn't? I love my Dom DeLuise.
I will say, having watched a lot of interviews with Don Bluth, Don Bluth also considers that he's a guy who seems pretty hard on himself. And he considers that his best film.
I will watch it immediately.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And The Secret of Nim was also a huge success critically, as well as it caught the eye of Steven Spielberg, who tapped Bluth and his team to make an animated film. He said, "Make me something pretty like you did in Nim. Make it beautiful." That movie was an American tale. So what do you guys think? Did Don Bluth make something beautiful, or is it a nightmare hellscape for children? Alicia, what do you think?
Can't it be both? It is beautiful. The animation is stunning and, you know, I think does outdo The Great Mouse Detective. I know we already stated this, but this comes out 4 months after The Great Mouse Detective in November. So it's obviously being poised as the big American Thanksgiving Christmas film. And it is stunning, I think. But it is dark. This is a film that I hated as a child. It scared the hell out of me. I didn't understand the cultural references, to be perfectly honest. Watching as an adult, I do admire it in terms of, you know, what they're able to pull off. It's an almost an animated version of Fiddler on the Roof, which is, of course, huge film in 1971. And it has elements of something like Hester Street, which is a film we talk about on the on season two of A Year in Film from 1975, directed by Joan Micklin Silver.
They are literally on Hester Street. There's an establishing shot where they zoom in and you see the street sign.
Yeah, which was a very important street neighborhood for Jewish immigrants in New York in the late 19th century and into the early 20th. So the film opens in Shushka, Russia, which I looked up is a real place and is today would be considered Ukraine, with, you know, a family of mice. Fievel's the young son. He has an older sister. There's a baby and his mother and father. And they're going to immigrate to America because, as the song says, there are no cats in America.
And the streets are filled with cheese.
Yes, which is only partially true. But the cats in this film are Cossacks. So much like The Great Mouse Detective, where you have the real Sherlock Holmes, the human Sherlock Holmes, and below him is the mouse world with the mouse version, you have human Cossacks invading and destroying and setting aflame a Jewish house because of the programs. And below that is the mouse family. So you get the kitty Cossacks who are then attacking. So that really compels them to immigrate to New York where there's no cats. And Fievel gets separated in sort of a unfortunate water situation. There's a really scary monster beast water thingy that was supposed to be even more scary, apparently, and be like a full-on sea monster. But Spielberg was like, yeah, this might terrify children even more.
Can I just say I think the one thing this movie really, really gets about kids is they have no concept of self-preservation whatsoever. Yeah. And I just think about my small person encountering their first wave pool, and they love to swim. They love to swim, and they love to go underwater. And they were swimming out further than us, and they were wearing a life jacket, and we realized that they were trying to struggle out of their life jacket because they wanted to go under the waves. And it was like, okay, we do not have a concept of what's going to kill us. Get back here. Let's go.
See, I was that kid and am still that adult that sits just where the waves are going over my legs on like the edge and
like,
I'm
that's
perfectly
nice.
Happy. But Fievel's not like that. He's very brave. So he gets separated. He does eventually make his way to New York, but his family actually kind of assume he's perished. It's very sad and very depressing. You get these great scenes at Castle Garden where so many of the ships coming over from Europe and in Russia land in New York. And you're getting these scenes kind of like The Godfather of, you know, people registering as new immigrants, as new Americans, giving their names, you know, in a foreign language, and it, the person, the American, writing it down.
Name?
Smovolodny Dromovichki.
Okay, Mr. Smith.
Like, I think the little sister in this is Talia, and she's then called, like, Tilly, or she's Tanya, and then they call her Tilly or something like that. And so Fievel gets renamed as Billy at one point, or Philly or
Philly,
something.
Yeah.
So there's
Philly,
a lot of name confusion. But he falls in with, not knowing where his family is, he falls in with sort of a bandit that is a warranty rat. Now, this is a spoiler. This is a rat. This is actually a cat disguised as a rat. And I don't understand how that possibly could happen, nor did my cat Chaplin.
He's a little cat.
He's a very small cat.
I mean, it's worth saying the weird thing that links these movies is both have things pretending to be not, because Rattigan's pretending to be a mouse and he's a rat, and this is a cat pretending to be a rat, which is weird.
You're not a rat, you're a cat.
There's a lot of mistaken identity, and he's sort of like an Oliver Twist Dickensian, like, Fagin character, and then he has a bunch of orphans and young kids that he kind of like trains to steal, and it's very scary. But they're also going to, like, because he's a cat disguised as a rat, they're like going to exterminate all the mice
and round them up and eat them. Like, that's the biggest thing. Is they're being very clear, these mice are going to be eaten that you have become attached
killed. They say fully killed. You see a mouse, an Irish mouse wake.
Irish mouse wake. Yeah, that is one of the more famous scenes.
All these party scenes, man. And also, we're forgetting that this one also has can-can dancers in the burlesque style, because he's mentored by a giant pigeon voiced by Christopher Plummer, of all people, doing a French accent.
In the most
accent,
like Maurice Chevalier impression possible.
Yeah.
Ah, no, my little immigrant. You want to find your family. And you will.
And then he has, like, a whole, if you will, brood of all these other pigeons that have plumage that makes them also look like burlesque performers. Who was thinking kids love can-can dancers? Who was thinking this in the 80s?
I mean, well, a lot of it, I think, is that Don Bluth is obsessed with kind of returning animation to the 1940s. And he actually fully said to play on boomer nostalgia for that Disney era. The other thing to, like, keep in mind with 1986 is 1986 is also coming after, in animation, the surprising success of Care Bears.
Huge.
Nelvana classic.
Yes. So suddenly these TV companies were making. Yeah. In addition to these two films, you've got Transformers, My Little Pony, GoBots, Battle of the Rock Lords. You've got a lot of cheap garbage. Though, I mean, Transformers looks pretty good. It looks like anime.
Orson Welles' final performance.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, anyway, so I think but he's like, I very keenly wanting to make 1940s style animation. So that's why I think you're getting some stuff like Sexy Link.
Well, and you're working with Steven 40. Spielberg as producer, right? Like, this is the first animated film from Amblin. And I think there's a little bit less of a children's animation sort of politic when you bring in someone like Spielberg, who, when he made children friendly films, were terrifying beyond belief, like E.T. I think it's like it's a little safer. It's a safer space because you don't have that name Disney on it. And this was like huge box office. This was the first non-Disney film to like destroy, to get like an animation basically record at the box office.
It beat the reissuing of Song of the South from Disney at the same time, which, you know, I'm actually kind of happy that happened. But even though that premiered third, I believe this premiered second. So like it did really well.
And it wiped the floor with great motion.
And, you know, it's released by Universal. Universal had not released a feature animated film since 1965's Pinocchio in Outer Space.
Wow.
Which is a film I have never heard of and am now very curious about.
Space whale? Or
I don't know. We're going to find out. I'm going to watch that and Secret of Nim.
We're going to find out. Good for you. It's interesting. And it's worth saying it was the highest grossing animated film of all time.
Is that true?
Very briefly. It's briefly because it got beaten by Oliver and Company. It's beaten almost immediately.
Okay.
That's why it's not remembered as that.
But the reviews are quite mixed. You know, Great Mouse Detective, as much as I kind of said, I didn't like this so much, reviews were, you know, critically very acclaimed. This was, like, basically mixed to negative at best yeah. in American Tale.
And yeah. part of the reason is because when they went into it, they wanted to make it for $9 million, which is basically impossible for this level of animation where you have an entire staff of people working on a deadline.
Yeah.
Like, it took 170 people to make The Great Mouse Detective on a
$16 million.
Exactly. And so when you yeah. think of how many people they had to have. So what they actually ended up doing, and they were very determined, no shortcuts, no CGI, we're going to do this the old-fashioned way to make it pretty. What they ended up doing was moving some of their work to Ireland. And the reason being is that the unions couldn't be operating over there. So they moved all the painting there to make it a lot cheaper. And that then later became one of the issues with Bluth and Company in general. Bluth Sullivan Entertainment was because they wanted to start making everything in Ireland, everything non-union. If people are paying mm-hmm. attention, there's actually a whole debacle going on right now in the United States about animation, because animation writers aren't represented by the WGA. They're represented by their own union and IATSE, and their standards are like a third of what, like their pay rates are a third. There's no guaranteed income for scripts.
Same with CGI people yeah. too, right? Isn't there some sort of loophole where they can be kind of worked to death? Yeah, it's interesting. Horrible. When you hear, I was kind of like, I never love a non-union thing. You know, Peter Jackson kind of falls in that same hole. But you hear Don Bluth. So one thing I want to point out, which I'm kind of fascinated by, is when we say Don Bluth left for college, he left for his Mormon yeah. mission and going to Brigham Young University. So, like, I think as well as, you know, coming back, I think he also had a renewed sense of purpose because he's like a devout Mormon. Hmm. And he's also somebody who says, It like, kind of fascinatingly, he's never married, and he says, yeah, like, I am married to art. So when he came back to Disney, I think he was really trying to be like an artist, and he does say that even then, part of the reason why he had these things in his garage is because he said everything at Disney was so union controlled you couldn't experiment mm-hmm. unless you did it out of your own house. Mm-hmm. So I think he falls in that artist thing where he always has felt very constrained by the unions. But I think, unfortunately, you do see that him and a lot of his productions are always trying cheaper, faster, you know. So what he gets is, like, he gets one really good one out of Secret of NIMH. Here he did say it was a fairly good process, but I think at the time it sounds like it's a real mess, and they were very cheaper, faster still. Then it's like Dragon's Lair, and then from then on he denigrates just about every yeah. movie that he worked on. And often it's like, he said Thumbelina, they got a script that he hated and he wrote it again in a week, and it's like, okay, well, that's not yeah. good for
well, and this one too, it sounds like they actually had a really incredible script that was, like, very clear, very concise, and very much marked out the immigrant story through Fievel. When he gets to America, it does feel a bit slapdash of, like, okay, this happens and now he's out. Like, there's never yeah. actually any danger. He's just sort of escaping. And because of the time, they kept having to cut scenes and cut scenes and cut scenes. And that's, mm-hmm. so you really are seeing this big chopped story, as opposed to taking the time to be like, well, we're just going to cut the sweatshop and now we're doing this.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently it's like a bunch of cuts were made because they wanted to preserve certain songs. Mm-hmm. The song, like, we should say that this is also a massive marketing undertaking. Fievel was co-designed by Sears to maximize his merchandising.
And named after Spielberg's grandfather, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which Don Bluth.
And then, but there was another executive who wanted it named after his grandfather.
Yeah,
and there became
that's
a whole
my
debacle.
Favorite part. Is like, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating because coming from Secret of NIMH, where Don Bluth essentially got to do what he wanted and make his own movies, he's now at the behest of Universal and Amblin, and sometimes at cross purposes. He actually fascinatingly says that he was shocked at how little Spielberg would allow terrifying stuff, that there was multiple terrifying sequences, and he's like, you're the guy who terrifies kids. what are you talking about?
As we also dive into this, I'm always amazed, because we have this with Jeffrey Katzenberg as well, who these executives who do not understand the time laborious problem or the editing mm-hmm. issues with animation, that you can't go in and cut and rewrite 2 hours of film. You're talking
yeah.
or 2 minutes
Spielberg
of film.
Spielberg really wanted to write this on the fly, kind of. And actually, like, as we're learning, I don't think I really knew this about Spielberg until we started doing A Year in Film, but Spielberg's thing is turning around a movie in 6 months,
yeah.
even as an old man.
Yeah.
That's his,
like,
he
shooting
loves it
in like 2 months,
seems.
Like 8 week shoots
yeah,
in Munich
yeah.
and War of the Worlds. And
yeah.
It's crazy.
War of the Worlds in Munich was like that. What the Duel, we found out, is like Duel was made in like a
yeah,
month.
Yeah, which is wild.
Like, he's a maniac and he loves doing like not slapdash, but like improvisational kind of on the fly. And it's like, you cannot do that.
It makes sense that he wouldn't work with Bluth again, right? Because he then goes back to Disney for 1988. And this is not, I mean, it is the Disney Renaissance, but it's live action. You know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is Spielberg and Disney just 2 years after this, and obviously changes Disney's future.
I think he's somewhat involved in The Land Before Time.
Yes, yes, he produced that one. That's 89 as well. 88, 89 as well. Yeah. He has a great quote, which I like, which he says, "Before this, I had been a bottomless pit of appreciation for animated films without knowing what went into making them. At this point, I'm enlightened, but I still can't believe it's so complicated." It's
like, Yeah. It sounds like he was kind of baffled. And honestly, it's worth saying that Don Bluth says he felt like now, looking at the fullness of his career, that working with Spielberg was very good, and Spielberg actually gave him a lot more freedom. Like, he still did not understand the lack of freedom you may have going forward. And also, I want to point out a very interesting thing that they utilized to go back to the Disney style, but allow it to be cheap, is this video printing, which was new. So essentially, like, you could do, because as you know, Disney has those beautiful films for reference where they shot these models acting like princesses. And so Don Bluth was able to videotape people and then essentially print out the video so they could do not tracing, more or less, but in a way that got those wonderful movements like classic Disney, which is just a cool
tech
thing.
They built the models of these two. Like, there was a model of the Mouse of Minsk and a bunch of other stuff. Like, anything big and complicated that happened to breathe fire, there is a model of that, which is wild.
The giant Mouse of Minsk is terrifying. It's really effective.
Yeah. Well, this is also, to keep everything from getting out, this is also the dawn of the NDA, not just for animation, but for film in general, where they were so terrified of Disney stealing any of their ideas and that they were working under such a tight restraint. Everybody was NDA'd. They were searching people's cars at the end of the day and doing pat downs to make sure no one was leaving with drawings. This is the first time you're seeing that happen.
That's fascinating to me.
And, I mean, a thing I also want to point out culturally is, like, this is still very groundbreaking, like, recitation of Jewish history. Because, I mean, we talk about Hester Street, which was very much ahead of its time as well. Shoah came out in 1985. So to talk about, like, you know, emigration of Jewish people, to have a film with Hanukkah in it is super
unheard of. Well, I also, you know, watching this as an adult, can't help but think about Art Spiegelman and the graphic novel series Mouse. It originates in the early 80s, I believe, but then in 1986 is published in its first sort of anthology. And so it's really like the first moment where you're seeing Spiegelman on bookshelves. And I do wonder, it's just so interesting that that comes out the same year as An American Tale, where you're having, you know, another story of, another metaphor for Jewish persecution at the hands of cats.
This was interesting, and I thought very astute. We talked about the critics skewering this, and they actually, like, went at this movie hard and very intelligently. And Charles Solomon from the Los Angeles Times had an issue with that, because he says, "Director Don Bluth and writers David Kirshner, Judy Friedberg, and Tony Geis use cats chasing mice to represent religious persecution, a metaphor that glosses over the central horror of the Russian pogroms. Oppression is not a conflict between predator and prey, but the willful cruelty the members of a single species inflict on each other."
That's a really good point.
And I mean, yeah, it's worth saying, two thumbs down, right? Siskel and Ebert.
Yeah.
They liked Mouse Detective. They did not like...
They loved Mouse
Detective. Their problem, I think, is...
They were groveling.
Oh, yeah. They were like, Disney is back, baby. But yeah, I guess theirs was more the scariness than if making insignificant the way people kill themselves.
Well, this song, we haven't talked about it yet, but the song, like, Somewhere Out There, which I think reached number 2 on, like, the Billboard 100, that is primarily what American Tale is remembered for, is like one very key song, which Great Mouse Detective did not have, to say the very least.
And it is a banger, and I understand that I am not using the term banger correctly, but I do think it is interesting.
I cry
that, like,
all the time
listening
to this song.
I do think it's interesting that you're seeing the two children sing it in the film, and it's charming and endearing, and then you're able to turn it around and have Linda Ronstadt, like, belt it out like the mofo that she is, right?
And that would go on to be a significant part of the Disney Renaissance, which is interesting, because it's not... I mean, I guess Melissa Manchester is kind of the equivalent, But Linda Ronstadt, worth saying, she did this as a favor because she was George Lucas's girlfriend.
What?
a fact I did not know.
For like a long time, too. Like, it wasn't just
I saw a thing that says no wedding bells for Lucas and Ronstadt, which I'm like, I mean, weird. But, you know, whatever. Go nuts. But yeah, it's kind of fascinating. And it was also that kind of duet with James Ingram, which I feel like was also a significant part of the Renaissance. Like, they would have these R&B kind of duets almost.
They were also very determined to have a lot of music in this, and they even cut songs too. Feivel in the sweatshop was planned to sing a song about the opportunity of America and how they were part of it to raise everybody's spirits. And I'm like, oh, it's probably for the best that's not in there.
Yeah, I mean, I love about this film is also it's like Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
Like you have these touches of like the Irish guy taking the names of the dead so they can stuff ballot boxes with them.
Oh yeah, Honest John. That's a real person.
Yeah,
there's a mouse that's Honest John that's truly based on a New York politician at that era.
So it's like this weird realism that is just unusual but charming to me as an adult.
We also haven't talked about some of the voice performances in this, which are fantastic. So my personal favorite, Madeleine Kahn, of course shows up. She's so fantastic in this. And she has this wonderful speech impediment, which I love. Yeah. And she pronounced it freedom. And it's just so, you can't help but laugh. She's one of the people, she just opens her mouth and you're like, that was funny. I don't know why, just funny.
Money is not everything. I know, because I have money and I have everything. But what are they worth without freedom?
It's very cute. I really love, I mean, I believe I've talked about Munchie quite a bit on this podcast, but Dom DeLuise, the voice of Munchie, is the one good cat, Tiger, who's, you know, a fat red cat with a t-shirt that's way too short. And I really love that.
I don't eat red meat at all. I'm a vegetarian. That's right. Oh, a little fish now and then. But what I really like is some nice broccoli.
That character shows up 50 minutes into this hour and a half long film. And I remember him as being like throughout the whole thing, but he doesn't. He shows up at the very end.
I think you're remembering him potentially because he's a major part of Feivel Goes West. And he's like on the cover. I think that's where I got confused, because I was with you. I'm like, where the hell is the one cat that doesn't eat the mice? And then it was like, okay, we're an hour into this film and he's just now appeared.
Yeah. It's well, but he wants to be a tough guy. He wants to be a tough
guy. It's
guy.
Very
so
cowardly
he's just
lion.
Doing
it's very
Bert Lahr.
Yeah, it's super cute.
Yeah.
So part of the reason why Universal wanted to develop this is they realized that their parks didn't have any children's attractions. And like Disney eventually realized, you have to make the movie so you can have the characters at the parks, which is where people really spend their money. That's the investment. They did this for Feivel and Feivel Goes West. So they had a mouse land that they built where everything was oversized that you could walk in. They didn't really have any rides, but they had a stage show where they had, again, built everything large. And then all the dancers were in like these big giant head costumes, but they built a giant robotic tiger, like animatronic puppet that would sing and dance and interact with them. And the head was operated with like bicycle handlebars inside. And so they would do like the entire show in like half an hour with all the music singing and dancing. And that was the attraction of Feivel. And that ran for a while till like the late 90s.
I'm going to say this.
Sure.
The giant mouse of Minsk, the roller coaster, was a missed opportunity.
Agreed.
Come on. Or like the water ride, like Immigration, the ship, it's a water ride. We're going to get wet.
Jesus.
Come on.
Immigration.
I don't work for a theme park and I can come up with this shit.
Oh,
oh my God. I am curious as to what the value of this would be for children. Now, don't get me wrong. I think understanding where people come from and understanding all of that is very important. But like, this gets so specific and so graphic and really horrific that I'm wondering what the message to children was meant to be, aside from this was a really horrible time in history. Let's not repeat it.
Yeah, I mean, Feivel's obviously the hero and he does a good job in scaring away the cats. But there's no like...
I mean, it's about loving your family.
Loving your family, perseverance.
Close.
Love
your broad Italian and Irish stereotype friends and make sure they fall in love.
I guess a lot of this era, like Land Before Time, you know, as well, like it's all about like you could lose your parents at any moment and you will be devastated, so you better behave. Like that's basically the message.
Yeah. I mean, Land Before Time became a very like religious series as well, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, I don't know. It's It's just a bunch of nonsense. What does the rescuers mean? What does the Great Mouse Detective mean? that video I recommended suggests it's partially about Irish persecution.
What? Okay. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I think that's exactly where we should end this episode. Perfect. It's not going to get any better than that. We're headed down a rabbit hole.
I'm going to watch Pinocchio in Outer Space.
That's for the best. What does that mean? Come back to me on that one.
Children need messages shoved down their throat at all times. Mm. Otherwise, just sit them in front of the television with flashing lights, colors, and like perfectly sequential musicals. That's all I need. That having been said, Cameron Maitland, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you, Becky.
It's always a pleasure. And Alicia Fletcher, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you. I will have to do a lot of repairing of my relationship with my cat by watching Aristocats, possibly Gay Paris. We're gonna have to do a lot of undoing of the recent Mouse Brigade.
I give you permission to go watch Cats again.
He doesn't like cats.
What? Really?
Yeah, it's a James Corden thing with cultural appropriation on Tuxedo Cats. He's not a fan.
Not a big fan. Totally fair. Poor Chaplin. Yeah. All right. And you can join us next week where we look at two movies which feature two very soon to be mega A-list stars. It's baby Keanu Reeves and a very jacked Nicolas Cage. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.